Our main speaker tonight, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Chris C.
My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 5th, 1987. And today is 18 years for me. Thank you, Rick, for asking me to do this. You know, I don't know if anything I say, if anybody's going to get anything out of what I say, but every time I do this, I share a little bit about myself and my experience and tell the truth about myself with the idea of helping someone. My spiritual in life is enlarged, and I come away with something. So I appreciate the opportunity. And thanks, Stephanie and Dave, also. Had good messages. 18 years ago today, I came to, and the night before, I'd been arrested one more time. And I came to in the morning with the familiar guilt, remorse, shame that I had lived with for some time and would come to every morning with. And the thing that was different about February 5th of 1987 is that I was completely defeated. I had absolutely no fight left in me. I mean, nothing was left. Something was completely different than all those other mornings where I would come to and I would still have the remorse, shame, guilt, and I'd be sick, I'd get the shakes and all the other stuff that we go through, but I still would have that lingering idea that, you know, it's going to be a little bit different somehow today. And, you know, throughout the day, I used to get the light bulb effect. You know, I would swear off drinking and somewhere after a few hours of feeling a little bit better, the light bulb would go off and say, you know, geez, if I only have a glass of water between each drink, then, you know, I'll probably be a successful drinker. And I'd live that way every day up to this point. February 5th, 1987, I was not afraid of dying. I was, in fact, if I had a crystal ball that, you know, said if I drank like this for another month or another 6 months, I'd be dead. I would have kept on drinking. My fear was that I was going to continue living the way I'd been living, and you know, death was a more attractive alternative than to keep on doing what I'd been doing. And I cried out to a God that I didn't even necessarily believe in, and I asked God to please make this stop or to kill me. I'd had some exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, and I just, in complete desperation, cried out to God, hoped there was a God, and immediately I'm somebody that the obsession and compulsion to drink was lifted, and I came into AA. 18 years later today, I woke up at 5:30 this morning, and I got up, I did my prayer and meditation, which I do almost every morning, and I kissed my wife goodbye of 12 and a half years. And let me share, 18 years ago, on February 5th, I was afraid of everybody. I was a daily oblivion drinker. I had nobody in my life. I was absolutely alone. I had a couple of fair weather drinking buddies that, well, I mean, and fair weather was giving them more credit than they really deserve. But I was absolutely alone. And this morning, I kissed my wife of 12 and a half years goodbye. I walked downstairs, and there was a card for my birthday along with a chip and a big book with some passages highlighted in it. And I went to a business meeting at 7 a.m. this morning. And from 7 to 9 a.m., I was in a business meeting downtown in a hotel. And the miracle in the business meeting is the fact that, you know, one is I have a job that I go to. Two, that I'm able to do that. But more so than the surface level miracle in that is the fact that I was able to participate in this business meeting this morning, and I wasn't afraid of the people that were in there. And, you know, 18 years ago, I was absolutely terrified of people. I was somebody that if I was walking down the street, if I was sober, if I was dry, if I was walking down the street and somebody else was coming the other way, I would cross the street so I wouldn't have to say hello to them because I was so terrified of people. And this morning I participated in a business meeting with you know, a group of about 50 or 60 people, and I had no fear. And that's a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and working the steps of my life. After that business meeting, you know, my phone just rang off the hook with people, you know, people that you know, were congratulating me on my birthday, and you know, and more people. I mean, more people called me today and said happy birthday to me today than people I knew when I got sober. And you know, a few people have asked me if I was nervous before the meeting, and I still get nervous. I've done this a few times, and have done it with larger crowds and smaller crowds, and it doesn't matter. I still always get nervous. Today I really didn't get nervous until just a few minutes before I got up here, because my phone was ringing off the hook so frequently today. I never had a time to really think about it, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. In a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I'm going to really kind of burn through my drinking and just kind of summarize it real quickly. It's kind of a funny thing. I spoke about 6 months ago at a meeting, and I said exactly the same thing. But prior to the meeting, I was thinking about, I was going to highlight my drinking. Okay, 14 alcohol-related arrests, detoxes, DTs. Two treatment centers, three DUIs, no job, daily oblivion drinking, blacked out every day, that I drank, wet the bed on a fairly regular basis. And I was kind of going through this in my head before I was going to go up and speak, and then I had this little voice that said, maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. And that's... that's the way that alcoholism manifests itself in my mind today. And that is kind of funny today. However, I will tell you that it bothered me at the time. And the magic of this program is I got on the telephone and I called about seven or eight people that are ahead of me in sobriety. And I told them exactly that same story, because it was bothersome. And every single one of those people answered the phone. They laughed, and then they shared a similar story. I mean, everybody, I called everybody from... one guy, I think the least amount of time, had 23 years, to a guy that had 48 years, and each one of them said the same thing. And that's the magic in one alcoholic sharing with another. Anyway, my drinking early on, I was characterized. The doctor's opinion talks about that we're maladjusted to life and full flight from reality, and one other thing. What? Outright mental defective. Scott knows that. and it says some to some extent, and to some of us to a considerable extent. I was somebody to a considerable extent. I had the disease of alcoholism. When I wasn't drinking alcohol, I felt different than, apart from, alienated from, severely less than, coupled with a superiority complex. I felt alienated from everybody on this planet. I was completely isolated. And the magic of alcohol is that 10 drinks made me feel like what I thought you people felt like normally. Not you people here, but those people out there. And, those 10 drinks allowed me to participate in life and do things that seemingly, came naturally to normal people. Things like dancing, or asking somebody to dance, or asking a girl out, or getting my hair cut, or going to the grocery store, or walking through a downtown street, or participating in anything social, parties or anything like that. And, the problem with it with the alcoholism is that, the 10 drinks works. The problem is that I would get, at times early on, I would drink to excess, and I'd black out, and sometimes I'd cause trouble, sometimes I wouldn't, so forth. And fast forwarding in the last couple of years of my drinking, and there was a lot of attempts to control it and to stop and so forth. The fall of 1985, I had a conversation with myself where I thought, I've been trying to control my drinking or moderate my drinking for a long time, and I can't do it. And, the bottom line is with me is I'm a drinker. And so, I'm no longer going to try to control my drinking. I'm just going to drink. I'm just going to admit that I'm a drinker and drink. And for the next 3 weeks, I drank to blackout every day. And at the end of the 3 weeks, I thought to myself, my God, am I going to be able to stop this? But that was easily pushed aside, because I've heard that alcoholism is the only fatal progressive disease that has a fun phase. And that was my fun phase. That daily oblivion drinking worked for me. And for about 2 months, there was a two-month window where drinking like that worked. I had no job. I did absolutely nothing but drank. At the end of a couple months, though, the problems started stacking up. And, you know, and all sorts of problems. Problem with people, problem with the law, so forth and so on. And once again, I started trying to control my drinking and or to quit altogether with no success whatsoever. In June of 1986, I went out drinking one night like normal. I came to the next morning with the shakes and full of guilt and remorse like normal. And I vaguely recalled something I had done the night before. And it was, you know, it was one of those traditional humiliating things that I had done. I was living in Ashland, Oregon at the time. And I hitchhiked from Ashland, because I didn't have a driver's license at the time. I hitchhiked from Ashland up to Portland to wean myself off of alcohol. And I was very, very scared about the DTs, because I'd get the shakes really bad. I mean, that was a daily occurrence. But I also would get auditory hallucinations when I'd come off alcohol, which is interesting. I used to get the auditory hallucinations. I'd be coming off alcohol, and I'd be walking down the street, and I'd hear voices behind me and organ music, and this little voice, Chris. And I'd turn around, and I really mean this when I say this, but I thought everybody had that when they had a hangover. I didn't know until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that that auditory hallucinations are not part of a regular person's hangover, that that's alcohol withdrawal. Anyway, I weaned myself off of alcohol, and on the third or fourth day, I ended up just falling apart. I mean, I was just coming unglued. I'd gotten chased around my bed by a rodent. The anxiety level was just coming apart. And I checked into the care unit over here on Lovejoy back in 1986. And the reason being is they had a fully a medical detox. And I went in that detox. I'd been detoxing for 3 days. I'd been weaning myself off with beer, you know, progressively lower beer. And I got in there, and they kept me on Librium for 5 days. They monitored my blood pressure around the clock. And there was guys that were coming in there that were like 60, 70 years old. They'd come in, they'd see snakes coming out of the wall 2 days, and then they would, you know, put them out into the public community treatment center. And I thought, you know what these people at these treatment centers are trying to do? They're holding me longer here to try to convince me that I'm worse than I really am. And then the treatment center closer came to try to close me on staying. And that was the physician, the staff physician who gave me a physical. And I got my physical, and she sat down with me and told me that I had this liver damage. And she explained, you know, the different processes or the stages of liver damage. And she said, at the time, I was 20 years old, and she goes, you have the liver of somebody who's been drinking for 30 years hard, and you probably won't make it to age 25. You definitely won't make it to age 30. And I knew immediately what she was doing. I mean, this was like, now, sign on the dotted line for our treatment center, you know, trying to convince me that I was worse than I was. Anyway, I went through the treatment center with only the intention of staying in treatment to get through the detox. Once I get through the detox, I'd go out and be okay. Got out of there, and I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings at the time. And, you know, whether it was selective hearing or whether it was just the meetings that I was going to, I did not hear anything. It seemed that in the meetings that I was going to, that they were talking about all this other stuff that just didn't seem to apply. And I would sit there and go, you know, but, you know, in my head, I'd be like, you don't understand. I don't like who I am when I'm not drinking. I'm the person I want to be when I have alcohol in my system. And so I don't get, you know, this pitch that they would, you know, that they would say. And anyway, there was all sorts of attempts to quit and control my drinking at that time, one of which shortly after that was I made a trip up to Alaska to a dry logging camp. I took from Ketchikan, Alaska, took a float plane about 100 miles out of there to an island called Hecate Island. It was a dry logging camp. You could not get liquor on the island. And I was on the island for 3 weeks, and two timber fallers showed up with a bottle of booze. And they said, you know, would you like a drink? And they handed me the bottle. I took the bottle, and I was like, you know, my mind is like, well, it's been 3 weeks, so I'm probably not an alcoholic. And I took the bottle, and I grabbed it, and I tipped it up, and I took about 3 gulps out of it, and they grabbed it from me and said, you know, hey, we got to make this last. You know, I thought we were just going to drink the bottle. Now, the problem is that I suffer from the phenomenon of craving. Once I take a drink or two in my system, I have a craving that's, you know, I mean, you guys know. I mean, it's right in the middle of me. I mean, it's just an itch that cannot be scratched unless I drink alcohol. And so here I am out in the middle of nowhere, a float plane arrived from the nearest liquor with the phenomenon of craving. So I endured that night with that craving. Next morning, I caught a float plane ride into Ketchikan, immediately went to a bar called the Folksal because I'd heard that that's the drinking bar in Ketchikan, you know, if you really want to drink. Went to the Folksal. The guy I was with, who was just the nicest guy in the world, who was on the logging camp with me, he had a drinking problem too. But the nicest guy in the world, we sat down at the bar and three drinks, he said, turned to me and said, "So you think you're pretty badass, don't you?" And it just, you know, the night just erupted from there. And I ended up in jail that night. So there's countless times of trying to control my drinking and AA and treatment and so forth. And I came to the next morning in this holding cell with two other guys. And there was the guy that was on the top bunk was hanging over the bunk looking at me. And I opened my eyes. He said, "Hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous." And he goes, "I've got 30 days sober, and my sponsor had made me come and serve my, I think he was serving 10 days. He owed an amends, owed 10 days, and he was in there serving his time." And I laid there, and I was like, "Oh, my God, I can't even get away from these people here in jail." Anyway, I got out of jail. I went to court, got out of jail, and I caught a ride plane back to the States. And the minute it was taking off out of Ketchikan, I thought to myself, never once did I think that alcohol was a problem. I thought to myself, I will never come to Alaska again. So from there, I fast forwarding several months of the, it's pretty much the same old thing. I was arrested 9 times in my last 12 months of drinking. I mean, my disease just progressed to where it was like, you know, every time I was drinking, and it didn't matter where I was. I got arrested, and that was 9 months, in Ashland, Eugene, Portland, and Ketchikan. And that was 12 months. Anyway, I went back down to Ashland, owed 8 days for my third DUI. And I was serving the 8 days on weekends. And the last weekend, between the third and fourth weekend, I managed to get arrested in between my jail time. And the Ashland Police Department took me aside and they said, "God, you know, Chris, you've got a hell of a drinking problem. You've got to do something." I mean, and these guys, I mean, they knew me. I mean, it was, you've got to do something. Go see this guy, Joe F. He's an expert on alcoholism. And I was like, yeah, whatever, you know. Anyway, the next day I was walking down the street and there's one of these sidewalk preachers in Ashland. And, you know, one of those guys that just stands on the corner with a Bible and spews scripture to anybody that happens to be coming by. His name was Monty. I knew him from jail. And as I came past Monty, he read something out of the Bible as, you know, blah, 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 you know. And I walked by and I thought, it tied into what the police department had said, and that was to go see this Joe F. And I thought, now, if I was one of those AA people, I wouldn't believe in coincidences. And I would say, oh, there's no coincidences. This must be God. I should act on it. And I kept on going, and then I thought, you know, for once in my life, why not take the opposite action? Instead of dismissing it as stupid or anything else, why not take the action as if maybe there are no coincidences? Maybe there is something to what those guys in AA are saying. And so I turned around, I walked up to Joe Fisher's, or Joe F. I walked up to his office, and he agreed to see me reluctantly, and before I was in there, I was like, please not Alcoholics Anonymous. Please, when I go in there, be, you know, aversion therapy, 10 days with a couple two-day follow-ups, and now his life's wonderful. I got in there, and of course, it was Alcoholics Anonymous, and he told me his story and invited me to a meeting. I, out of sense of obligation, I went to the meeting that night with him. It was Thursday night Clay Street meeting in Ashland. And at the time, that meeting doesn't exist anymore, but at the time, it was a primary purpose meeting. If there was a newcomer in the room, they talked a little bit of what it used to be like so the newcomer could identify with them what happened and what they had to do to get sober and what it's like now. And it was speaker discussion, speaker talked for about 20 minutes, and then they called on people. And I sat in that room in the very back, you know, and I went through the drill, you know, I'm an alcoholic, you know, I'm first 30 days and so forth. And I was just essentially doing this as an exercise because I felt obligated to Joe. But when that speaker talked about his, you know, his or hers, whatever it was, their experience with alcohol, I started identifying a little bit. And then the next person they called on, then the next person, all of a sudden it was just like, man, these people do drink like I do. And here they are, you know, 6 months sober or a year sober or 5 years sober. And there's one guy, in fact, that stood up and he talked about coming out of a blackout with a revolver in his mouth and had gone back in the blackout, came to on the floor the next morning with the revolver next to him. And I had almost the identical story, except for mine was I was holding a knife to myself and went back in the blackout, came to the next morning, you know, on the floor with a knife next to me. And it was, I mean, he told a piece of my story. And it just, I came away from that meeting with some hope. And it was the first time I'd ever had any hope. And I had so much hope that I didn't drink the rest of that day, and I didn't drink the next day. Now, I didn't go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. That was on January 29th, 1987. On February 4th of 1987, I went out one more time to prove that I could drink like normal people. I was going to go out and drink 10 drinks and then and then shut it down. And I was going to shut it down and come home, get a good night's sleep, get up, and be like a normal, respectable citizen. And the guy that was supposed to go drinking with me was late, and I drank 9 drinks sitting there waiting for him to pick me up. You know, so I kind of already shot my, you know, my wad on my drinks before I even left. I went down to the bars. I did my normal routine. I had one hand over one eye, you know, cause, to keep from seeing double. I ended up in another bar. That night I secured a job as the bartender of my favorite drinking establishment, and then within an hour was attacking the guy that gave me the job. I had him over the top of the bar, and police were called one more time, and I was arrested. And when I was arrested, you know, and I'd been arrested, obviously, a few times, and but something about this arrest, I mean, I was just, like I said when I started, I was absolutely defeated. And before they cuffed me, I sat there, and the officer had his hip next to me, and his revolver was there. And I thought, you know what, I'm not going to go to jail and do this anymore. Grab the revolver and shoot him and flee. And then my next thought was, no, you know, I get caught on everything. Grab the revolver and shoot myself and just end this. And before I could act on it, they cuffed me and took me in. And anyway, the next morning was February 5th, 1987. And I came to with just absolute desperation and the hope that Alcoholics Anonymous would work. And as I said earlier, I said the prayer, God, you know, please make this stop or kill me. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and what they told me to do when I got here was go to 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor, read the big book, start working the steps, and call other people in the program. And I started doing it. And like I said, the compulsion to drink was expelled immediately. However, I was left with a problem, and that was the alcoholism. I still suffered from depression and anxiety. Depression and anxiety for me is the natural state of untreated alcoholism. You know, if I don't work a spiritual solution or I don't drink, I suffer from anxiety, depression, a sense of apartness, inadequacy, low self-worth, and all those other things that I mentioned earlier. And those progressed in my early sobriety. They got worse and worse and worse. In 45 days of sobriety, I had no desire to drink. But at 45 days of sobriety, I had an anxiety attack that landed me in a hospital. And, you know, and I kept going, and that kept progressing. And I'll tell you one quick story just to give you an idea of how the alcoholism affected me. I took a psychology class at this time. I had about 7-8 months, and I hadn't done my fourth step. I stopped in my third step. I took a psychology class, and it was a big auditorium class, and the professor was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he gave us one of these personality exams. It was some sort of stress exam, and it was a lengthy deal, and we scored ourselves. It was just for self-examination type purposes. And in this auditorium class, he said, who scored here between 0 and 25? About 10% of the class. He said, you people have very little stress in your life. You are somebody that handles life, you know, just, you know, like water off a duck. Who scored between 25 and 50? About probably a third of the class, raise their hand. You people react to stress normally. And then the next, who scored between 50 and 75? Most of the remaining people, raise their hand. You people have a little bit of stress in your life. You have, you know, just you're seemingly normal in all capacities, but you got a little bit of stress, so you don't deal with stress very well. Who scored between 75 and 100? There's like five people that were brave enough to raise their hand. You people have had a tragedy in your life. You've had, you know, a loss of a family member, a divorce, you know, a significant move. Anybody score between 100 and between 100 or 125? No. Anybody above 125? Now, I was 146, and typically institutionalized for life or locked up in a federal, you know, in an institution or a federal penitentiary. So afterwards, I went down to this this professor of psychology who was in the program, and I said, you know, doctor, I scored 146. And he said, what you have is untreated alcoholism. Anybody in their first year would score above 125. Do your fourth step. But I dismissed that that advice. And about a month later, I called a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in complete despair because the alcoholism was just, you know, kicking my ass. And he said something to me, and I want to say this before I say this because I get accused of this if I don't say this once in a while. This is not an indictment to anybody that's on antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication. This is simply my experience. This guy said, you know, what you have, Chris, is something other than alcoholism. You know, this is something that Alcoholics Anonymous probably can't help you with. Yeah, he hadn't read the book, apparently, because our book is filled with our problems centered in our mind, and we had to get down to causes and conditions and so forth. But he said, you need to go see a psychiatrist and get on some anti-anxiety or antidepressant-type medication. And I got off the phone, and I hit a bottom. And this is about 8-9 months sober, and I hit a bottom similar to the one that I came in here. And I was like, God, I thought I had a solution. I thought I had a solution. I thought I had a spiritual solution that would take care of my problems. And yet, here's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's saying, no, we don't have a solution for you. You need to go do something different. And I got off the phone, and I resolved, after thinking about it for a moment, that I'm not going to go get on anything. I've been medicating. I've been anesthetizing myself with alcohol all my life. I'm not going to go get on something again. And so I made the decision, I'm going to get on that fourth step, like everybody's been saying, you know, over and over and over. And I'm going to do steps 4 through 12 exactly as they're outlined in the big book. And when I get to step 12, if I don't have any relief from this, then I'm going to kill myself. And so I started in on that fourth step, and I wrote just, I mean, in a very thorough fourth step. And I got together with my sponsor to do my fifth step, and one very important thing that he did when I sat down to read this thing with him is he shared his deep, dark secrets with me before we started. And the magic of the fifth step and that process started when he did that, because I was no longer alone. I really thought I was the only one that had done a lot of the stuff that I had done. I mean, I never had heard another man admit to some of the things that he admitted to, which were similar to the things that I had done. And I read that fifth step. One of the things that I always would do was a common practice of mine when I wasn't drinking, in between drunks, was I would go to the mirror and I'd either tear myself down or build myself up. I had such feelings of inadequate and low self-worth that I would sit there and just pick on myself, or the feelings of superiority would come and I would build myself up, but then immediately those would be supplanted in a few minutes with the feelings of inadequacy. And after I did that fist up, I went to go do this routine that I'd been doing for years and in the mirror, and I looked in the mirror and there was no reaction. And I sat there and I was like, you know, what's this? Because that reaction was always based on something that happened inside of my soul. And it wasn't something I manufactured in my head. It was the way I felt in my core. And I looked in the mirror and nothing happened. And I was trying to identify, what is this? What is this I'm feeling? And what I realized is that it was comfort. And it was the first time I'd experienced comfort in my own skin in my entire life without having, you know, a certain amount of alcohol in my system. At least in as far back, maybe as a child I did, I don't recall. And I came out of that fifth, sixth, and seventh step with a new reaction. I had some comfort, and my life began to unfold. I started walking through fears. Like I said, I was the type of person that was so afraid of people that if I was walking down the street and somebody else was coming the other way, I'd cross the street to avoid eye contact or having to say hello to them. And that stuff all started changing after doing this inventory process. And my life just unfolded for the next several years. I did things that were just remarkable. I became a participant in life. I'd never been able to participate in life without alcohol. And through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I became a participant. You know, I did things like, I got a job as a stockbroker. You know, here I'm somebody that can barely function, and, you know, I'm now a stockbroker in sobriety. I got married in sobriety. I just all sorts of things. I don't have enough time to really elaborate on that. But my life continued to me. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I became a believer in the design for living after working the steps, after doing that fourth, fifth, and sixth, and seventh step. And I just want to share briefly, when I got around 7 years sober, I very subtly and very slowly got away from doing the things that made me feel comfortable in my own skin, and I got dry. And the cunning, baffling part of alcoholism is that my mind told me that at 7.5 years, the solution must be something different than the basic program of Alcoholics Anonymous that worked in the first place. And I kept saying, I shouldn't feel this way at 7.5. But our big book talks about we have a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And luckily, I had enough, or God, or whatever it was, that said, you know, entrench your life back in Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no alternative, and I did that. And at 7.5, 8 years sober, I went back and had to go through and find out what powerless meant at 7.5, 8 years. And I had to go back and write another inventory. At that inventory at 8 years sober, I had like 105 or 110 resentments on that list. I mean, I'd gotten so far away and so removed from this program that I was walking out of my living room every day with 110 resentments. And once again, the program worked. Now, it didn't happen overnight, but through the work and the suggestions in the Big Book, little by little, Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous gave me what alcohol gave me quickly. And that's been my reaction in life since. I am still somebody today that of myself I cannot keep from drinking. And of myself, I'm somebody that is full of anxiety, full of resentment, full of fear, full of depression, and all this other stuff. But when I put myself, in the middle of this thing and really entrench my life and really do it, I'm not somebody that can go to meetings and talk about the 11th step. I'm somebody that actually has to do the 11th step. And there's a difference for me. I have to participate in this program. And when I do, the Big Book talks about a fourth dimension of existence. And I get that. I get that fourth existence not all the time, but a lot of the time. Some of the time I just get a piece of it. And it's truly, from practicing a spiritual program of action. And I just want to close with something that Chuck Chamberlain used to always say, and it's true for me today, and that is, I have two choices. I can either live a self-centered life and suffer the consequences, or I can live a God-centered life and suffer the consequences. Thanks for my sobriety.